Well, briefly, this adventure started when I was in Hawaii, and my neighbor, one Jerome Goodspeed, planted a row of pole beans, climbing beans. And when they were about a foot high, they began to send up runners. And I said, Jerome, how long have you been growing these beans? And he said, oh, 15, maybe 20 years. Well, in all that time, have you ever noticed any turn the other direction? And he looked at them, and he says, you know, they do all turn the same direction, don't they? So I deduced that Jerome was a poor observer. So then I said, look, you got a lot of them. There's more than you can possibly eat. How about letting me do an experiment on these beans? And I will take all the odd-numbered ones and leave them alone, 1, 3, 5, and so on. But all the even-numbered ones, 2, 4, 6, and 8, I will arbitrarily unwind and wind backwards. And then I'll keep on doing that till they grow to the full height. And then we'll see how the plant responds, if we can make any estimate. And so he said, sure, no harm. So I did. And the reverse vines seemed to grow just as tall, 6, 7 feet high, maybe more, as the normal vines, and they had luxuriant foliage and prolific flowering, and they had a lot of pods on them. And couldn't see it made any difference whatsoever. And I tried picking some of the pods from the normal vines and some from the reverse vines and cooking them up separately and trying them out to see if they were any more tough or fibrous or anything like that. I couldn't see it was any difference whatsoever. Well, I thought, that's wacky. That is, the plant is being tortured. It must respond in some way. And I just have been able to figure it out. So about that time, I left Hawaii and came here. And I had Jerome give me some seeds, handful or cupful. I brought them along. So I was living at Hill House, and I prevailed upon one of the local farmers to come and dig up a plot there, which is still open, I find. And I planted some beans. I also cased among the local people for some other kind of beans. I think I had a total of 4 different varieties. And we planted about 30 sticks, 30 poles worth. And again, I left the odd ones, 1, 3, 5, and 7 alone, and tortured the even number ones. And the normal vine goes like a right-hand screw thread. If this is the plant, it comes in front of you and goes behind like this, and in front of you and behind and so on, see? So what you do is you have to be at this thing. That is, you can't let the thing grow up like that and then unwind it all and wind it back. It's after a few days, this runner will get a set and it'll become hard. And if you try to bend it, it'll break. So it's about the top 6 inches is still quite pliable. So you have to go out every couple days and unwind it. And you wind them backwards like this and then behind and like this and so on and so on. And then you come to the end and you tie it. And the plant, though, is very stubborn and it won't continue on. It finds its own way and goes like this. So this is the bud on the end. So then after it's made a turn or two, you go out and unwind it and wind it backwards and tie it again. And you keep doing that until it gets to the very top. So the same thing happened. You couldn't see that there was any difference, at least by inspection. The size of the leaves or the number of pods or the color of the flowers or anything like that. I tried this on 4 different brands. One of them was a white one, and the other two had markings on. So I thought, all right, we aren't learning anything. So instead of picking these, I'll let them mature and dry. And that seemed to be the crucial point. When you're dealing with the green ones, you got an unknown amount of water in them, and a large amount, and you have no control over it or any estimate of it. But if you let them mature and dry and wither, and then they turn like tan color, then this thing shows up. So you have pods with various numbers of beans, say 1, 3, 5, and 7. And you take 100 pods as your sample, 100 pods, 1 bean, 100 pods, 3 beans, and so on. Then you weigh the pods, and you find that, lo and behold, the grams per pod decreases. See, this all is going to be reverse divided by normal. The grams per pod decreases as the number of beans in the pod increase. And it becomes rather substantial when you have a long pod. And some of them went up, I think, to 9 and even 10, but not many. So you say, okay, it's probably something about the beans. So you shuck the pods and get the beans out, and lo and behold, there's no difference. That is, the beans would be 100 beans here, 300 beans, and so on. And so you find the ratio of the grams per bean on the normal and the reversed, and that ratio is 1. So this activity didn't change the weight of the beans. You didn't get larger beans, you didn't get smaller beans. On the average, they were exactly the same. Okay, if the pods are lighter, but the beans are the same, it must be the shucks. So I saved the shucks and weighed the shucks, and when there's only one bean, you can't see it has any effect. But with 3 beans, it begins to show. 5 beans and 7 beans, it's very pronounced. In other words, the pod that has 7 beans in only has a shuck that weighs 65% as much as the normal one. So the plant reacts by taking some of the energy it expends in making the shucks, and I don't know what it does with it. Anyhow, it makes lighter shucks, see? So I try to find out if the shucks were thinner with a micrometer. They're all so crinkly you can't make anything out of them. So that was pretty hopeless. And it did this for all 4 varieties. Some of them were more pronounced. The one that I brought from Hawaii was the most pronounced. And then there's a kind which is red with purple streaks on. And then there was some black ones, and I forget. There was, I think, 3 colored ones and 1 white one. Okay. So it wasn't any peculiarity or particular variety. It apparently the plant on all varieties responds in the same manner, more or less. About that time, I noticed another thing. Now, the standard bean that I brought from Hawaii was tan, and it had some black streaks on. These are supposed to be the black streaks, and the white is supposed to be the tan. However, some pods had what I called, see, that's a standard bean, what I call an inverted color. In which case, the bean was black and the markings were tan. And whenever you found one of these beans, all the beans in the same pod were the same. That is, they didn't mix. You didn't find some standard beans and inverted beans in the same pod. They were either one way or the other way. And the plant did that voluntarily, and for some unknown reason, at least to me. So I saved these out, these inverted color ones, and planted them separately with the thought that it might be possible to raise a new variety that was inverted color, but it didn't. These things lacked the ability to reproduce themselves. You plant these things, and instead of getting more of these things, what you do is you get a weaker plant which produces mostly standard beans, and there's a few of these. And if you persist over 2 or 3 years, as I did down there, these will ultimately die out. I don't know what that proves genetically, but the situation is continually being replenished by some of these inverted color beans growing on regular vines. So then I thought, okay, I'll do an investigation of these. And so I then took the ratio of inverted to standard on the normal vines and the reversed vines. And when there was only one bean in a pod, they were sensibly about 2%. Didn't make any difference. But when the number of beans increased, I got more of these inverted color beans, from 3% to about 3.5%, and from 4% to 5%, and from 5% to 7%. So the plant reacted another way. It reacted by producing more of these inverted color beans. And it rather significantly, see, is it nearly a 40% increase here.
But this was out of 100 beans, so you're talking about
100 pods.
100 pods, but 5 instead of seven. So.
Well, you won't get much with this, see? You only got 100 beans to deal with.
Yeah, I know. I'm just saying you might have had 6. The answer might be 6 plus or minus 1, in which case
you couldn't tell
the difference.
It was a very small amount. Yeah. In other words, these aren't real indicative. You'd have to use more groups, except to the extent that maybe I only had 100 of one variety, but I had several varieties. And this kind of thing appeared in all the varieties to a certain extent. Well, I don't know anything about it. So, at this point, another thing happened, quite unexpected. Now, these things, when they dry, turn tan. And about the second year I tried this down there, there was 2 plants. And I don't recall that they showed any peculiarity for me to note it when the plants were young. That is, there was nothing to attract my attention. But when the plants matured, the leaves fell off, and the pods dried, these 2 plants didn't have tan pods. They had purple pods. And the purple pods had some of these things in. But you could find these things in ordinary tan pods. So there was something about those 2 plants that produced an abundance of these things. But more than that, I saved them, and I maybe had 60, 70 beans to play with, and I put about 4 or 5 in a position. And I raised those, and lo and behold, what happened? There was some kind of a genetic breakdown, and I got about 5 different colors of beans out of these peculiarity ones. And not only did the beans change color, but the flowers changed color. Now, the normal flowers on here are violet with a white standard. Well, pardon me, it's the other way around. Violet standard and a white keel. That's the part. See, I think they call this the standard. That's the petals. And then there's this thing sticks out in front. That's the keel. But that changed. And I tried planting those, and there were some round ones. There was two kinds of white ones. There was round white ones, just like peas, and then there was elliptical white ones, like beans, and I planted those. And these were fertile, but these were infertile, and not a single one sprouted. So it came to a dead end. Well, you see, there's a controversy going on in the botanic or the biological world about these the genetic situations where you have a string of descendants, and they gradually develop, and then there's a big discontinuity, and you get a new string. And some people say that this is because your sample is inadequate. You missed a 8 or 10 generations. And other people say that there was a big genetic change just at one spot, see? I can't describe it properly. But apparently that's what happened here. And I unwittingly encountered this, that there was a genetic change which caused this kind of a thing to appear with all these different varieties. And some of them were ineffective, like that one, couldn't reproduce themselves. But others were. I think that one had yellow flowers, which was completely disconnected from the purple and white flowers of its ancestors. And there were other combinations which I wrote down. So, all this is neither here nor there, but now to show you the general outlook on life. I don't know anything about this stuff. I never took a course in botany in my life. I just do these things to see what's going to happen. If you keep your eyes open, interesting things happen. So at the University of Tasmania, they had a great big fellow named Barker, who was professor of botany. And his specialty had something to do with eucalyptus trees. Anyhow, I went to see Barker, and I related and gave him statistics on some of these things, not particularly that, but mainly that. And I said, now, the reason I've come to see you is because you have had a great experience in botany, and I was wondering if at any time you have encountered any papers that describe things such as I have done here, and what the results might be. He looked at me as though he was looking at a nut, and he said, never. So that was the end of Barker. I didn't get anything out of him. So the CSIRO down there has a lot of stuff which is disconnected from what they most people think of as hard science, but they got things like fisheries and forestry and food preservation and plant industry and so on, see? Anyhow, there was a New Zealander there named Otto Frankel, and he worked his way pretty high up in this division of plant industry. And so the officer in charge there, Don Barton, said, Otto Frankel is in the library. Would you come in and tell him what you have been doing with beans? I said, sure. So I came in there, and Otto listened. And when I was all through, he was sitting there like this. When I was all through, he's sitting there like this. He said, there's no reason why it should be, it can't be, and I don't believe it. Well, sir, it's your privilege. See, but now look at, he's way up the line in his botanical business of the plant industry, and he's got a lot of flunkies. Instead of sitting there and deriding the whole thing is bunk, all he had to do was get a couple of his flunkies and put them to work, and anybody in about seventh grade can do that. But he didn't. Well, okay. Now, that same summer, they had some students here, and on a Saturday, I think I had 5 students, and we went on an expedition over into the hills. And we hunted around and looked for various things, and I noticed some vines. And some of these students were brought up in an apartment in New York, and they were very frightened of the wildlife. every leaf had a caterpillar on it who was going to bite them, and every piece of ivy was going to sting them, and there were going to be snakes around. They couldn't see the snakes now, I don't know. It was real real frightening for some of these kids. I thought it was pretty sad. They'd been brought up in the flat and they didn't know anything about the life of the country. Well, then another Saturday, see, we went over past Deer Creek, over the hill in that next valley. What's the name of that creek?
Where the Greenbrier River is.
Greenbrier.
Right.
It's much bigger than Deer Creek. Anyhow, this fellow, Claude Sinclair, and I, and one other fellow who was a draftsman here at the time, I can't seem to remember who his name was, rather stocky fellow. Well, anyhow, we went over there, and the purpose of the expedition was to hunt for twining vines. And we were pretty successful. We were over there maybe 3 or 4 hours all afternoon. And lo and behold, we found 9 different kind of twining vines. You could tell they were different from the leaf structure and so on. And 4 of them turned one way and 5 of them turned the other way. So at any given location, if you hunt, you can find a considerable number of these twining plants, some of them going one way and some of them going the other way. So this puts to sleep this dogma that the vines turn one way in the northern hemisphere and turn the other way in the southern hemisphere. So I then read some more about this stuff, and somehow down there I stumbled on a book written by some Englishman in the heyday of British India. And he apparently was a professor at the University of Bombay, but he didn't have anything to do, and he had a lot of easy labor. And so he went out in the bush hunting for plants and trees and whatnot that hadn't been ever described before. And he wrote a volume on twining vines, twining plants. This was about maybe 1905. I think it was the Royal Botanical Society of Calcutta. And half of it he devoted to left-hand turning vines, and half of it he wrote to right-hand turning vines. And it was about 400 pages in the whole book, along with all the illustrations and drawings and stuff, and where these things were found, and the description of the leaves and so on. Anyhow, by pages, it was about half and half. So in India, about half the vines turned one way, and half the vines turned the other way. So India is the same as Deer Creek. Well, this began to tickle me, see, the botanist guys. Because I was looking for somebody who'd done something like this, and nobody had, see. So, this was a couple of years later, I was visiting a friend in Pasadena, and he taught at one of the local schools. So he was going all day, and I thought I'd take the day and go see what the Santa Ana Botanical Gardens had to offer. So I wandered around the Santa Ana Botanical Gardens and saw a variety of things, and there was one thing that attracted me. And they had a very open mesh wire netting, about 3-inch square mesh, about 8 feet high on some pegs. And at the bottom, they had some bulbs, like onions. And these things were sending up shoots like onions. And you know, at the top of an onion plant, a seed pod forms, and then it breaks open, and there's this cluster of small white seeds or yellow seeds. Well, these things are doing pretty much the same, except much more taller. An onion that only goes maybe this high. But these things were going up about 7 or 8 feet high. And the thing that attracted me was some of them were going one way and some of them were going the other way, see? In other words, here was some kind of a plant of which some of the individual plants were going one way and some going the other way. So I got a hold of one of the women gardeners around there, and she says, well, go see Mr. Ball. He's the chief gardener. So we hunted around and found Mr. Ball, and I explained this to him, and he looked at it. And yes, he knew about these plants, but nobody had ever called it to his attention that some were going one way and some were going the other way. but he agreed they were. So I said, well, who do you think knows about this? So we wrote down the Latin name of this thing and went in to see their chief botanist, Mr. Everett. So I went in to talk to Mr. Everett, and Ball stayed, and I discussed this with him, and I asked him where these things came from, and he didn't know exactly, but he had one of his clerks fish in the filing cabinet. They got out a file, and they came from somewhere up on the side of the mountain, 2,500 feet or so, and they'd had them there for 3 or 4 years. And apparently, while they go to seed at the top like an onion, they don't propagate that way. They propagate like an onion, that is, a new bulb start at the side and so on. Well, this more or less intelligent discussion went on for a while, and I asked him about getting some of these. I'd take them with me, see? He says, well, this isn't exactly the right season. See, you should do that when they're dormant. Well, about this time, a big, large, gray-haired fellow came in and injected himself into the conversation. And so I tried to explain that I was interested in these plants, some of which turned one way and some of turned the other way. And he acted as though he wasn't even listening. And he started an argument with Everett about where they got these things. And so I said, now I have been playing with beans for some years, and I've raised them in West Virginia and in Hawaii, and have taken the same beans and tried them in the Southern Hemisphere, and they all turn the same way. He says, you didn't do it right. I says, how's that? And he says, it's been proved in the literature that they turn one way in the Northern Hemisphere and the other way in the Southern Hemisphere. See? So, you know, you don't just start a three-ring argument with some guy like that. So this went on for a little while, and I got tired of it. And so Ball and I went out and left his joker with Everett, see? So after we got out, I said to Ball, who is that big gray-haired fellow with a crotchy to this position? He says, oh, that's Dr. Muntz. He's the director. We wandered around a while. It was getting late in the afternoon, and so I went back to the people I was staying with. And by this time, the gentleman had gotten home, and so we had something to eat. And I explained what I had seen and heard and encountered. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. Dr. Mutz is that way, and he's written a new book. We'll go over to the university library and get this book. So we did. And he hunted through this book. And lo and behold, in the book it said, just as old Mutz said, that the beans turn, or the twining vines turn one way in the Northern Hemisphere and they turn the other way in the Southern Hemisphere. So Mutz knew what was going on in the literature, but he didn't have the faintest idea what's going on in the garden. So you see, you think the physicists are nuts, you should try the botanists. So this kind of thing went on and on and on, and I kept my eyes open, and I was up to Flinders Island, which is one of the offshore islands, and I found a delightful plant there. It apparently lives for many years, and some plants, you know, send out runners, and they put a root down and another root down, and then new plants generate from these roots. This one didn't. It had one center root, and it spread out, and it maybe covered an area as large as this room, and it was hard to find all the runners. And every time it came to a cluster of grass or a small bush, it climbed up. And so I took some of this back and noted it. Now, you know how a tomato plant has a main stalk, and then there's a leaf, and then a new stalk starts off at the leaf junction. That's the way this thing propagated. And so I noticed that some of these runners were going one way and some of them going the other way on the same plant. So I took some of the these things and tried to propagate them, but I wasn't successful. So then I went back another time, and this time I found some, it was in the winter, and I found some young plants which were dormant. And so I put them in the cans and brought them back and planted them. And they took off and grew tall, 6-8 feet. And they had prolific leaves and lots of flowers, but no seeds. I thought, how the hell is that, see? So I got my botanical friend to go out there and look at this thing. And he looked it all over very carefully. He says, boy, you'll never get any seeds out of these. I said, what's the matter with that? He says, you got all male plants. So apparently some varieties of plants have to have both sexes if they're going to propagate. Well, this kind of thing went on and on and on. And I wrote, I think, 3 articles about this, and I got a few requests, but as far as I know, at this late date, nobody's ever done it. So here's an opportunity for somebody, if they're interested, to go out and manipulate their bean plants and see if they can do anything. Now, Barker hadn't heard of anybody doing this, and Bunch and Otto Frankel, they were dead set against it. So the matter is still open. So there you are, gentlemen.
Were all the variations from the reverse wound plants, the variations that you got in the bean itself, were they all from the plants that were reverse wound?
No. These standard inverted color beans grew on normal plants too, but they grew a little more profusely on the reversed, but not greatly. As a matter of fact, as he pointed out, the statistics is poor. If you've got 100 pods and you, or 100 beans and you only got 7 to deal with, it's not a convincing demonstration.
I'm afraid, isn't there a confound in your experiment? Did you unwind the normal ones, then wind them back, then tie them?
Mm-hmm.
You did that on the normal ones?
Well, all the odd-numbered poles were let alone, so they produced a vine like this.
You didn't touch them?
Didn't touch them.
So you don't know if the differences you're getting are because you were handling them and tying them, or because they were reverse wound? Right.
One of my friends said, the whole trouble, Groat, is you don't know what you're doing. I said, that's true.
He was getting around to that.
He says, you got something on your hands, and that rubs off onto these vines, and it gives them that effect, see? You should get somebody else to do it that doesn't have the same stuff on their hands. See? He didn't know what the stuff was. I says, fine, Charlie, you're it. He disappeared. Could be, I don't know.
Do any of the beans wind in the opposite direction of the majority? Do any of the beans naturally go in the reverse direction?
No. See, I asked that of my friend Jerome Goodspeed if in those many years he'd ever seen any going the other way. And apparently he was such a poor observer, he didn't really know. But over the years that I've handled these things, I must have handled 1,000 vines, and I never did find one going the other way.
The same plant in this hemisphere and in the other hemisphere will still go right-hand spruce then.
Yeah, they'll grow like that in any hemisphere.
Yeah.
It's got nothing to do with Coriolis force. It can't have anything to do with touch, because if it was touch, they'd be random. And so then I inquire from my botanical friends how the bean grows. Now, the grass grows from the bottom. You can cut the tops off and it'll keep coming up. But these don't. These grow from the top, the bud. And if you cut the bud off, that runner will stop. And the bud at the end, something like that. And if you look under a microscope, you find it's made of a whole flock of little cells. And these the thing grows by these cells elongating like that and breaking in two, and then they keep going. And what makes them do that? And I find that there's a catalyst that they call indole acetic acid, and it's generated in the tip of the cell, and it runs down and actuates, or at least enhances, this characteristic of elongating and dividing. At least that's the explanation I get. Now, the next step has not been proven, but it would appear that the indole acetic acid runs down one side of the bud more than the other. And if this be true, the cells on this side will elongate more than the other side. And consequently, the vine will turn over. So you explain it all by one unexplainable thing. How does the indole acetic acid know which side?
See, this is a very common thing, see? Everybody knows now how I divine twine.
But that other plant that I told you that I found on Flinders Island that spreads all over, you see, if this is the main vine and there's a leaf here, then there'll be a secondary one go off here, and there maybe be another leaf here and a tertiary one off here. And I don't remember that I looked too closely, but the chances of having this one turn the same way as that one are small, and this one turn the same way as that one are small, but the chances between this one and turning that way are fairly large. In other words, it tends to reverse at each junction. You'd have to do a bigger study with a large statistical sample. I still don't know what I'm doing. Well, okay, gentlemen. That's the beans.
We have gardeners here.
Yeah.
So this all started over just east of Hill House. And that's the reason I thought it would be appropriate. Now, one more thing. There is some kind of a botanical society at Charleston, and they publish a little journal, I think quarterly, called Castanea. And I wrote this stuff up, the first part of it, not this part, the first part of it, and sent it to Castanea. And the editor wrote back and said that we're very pleased to receive your contribution, and that we're in favor of new and different kind of scientific effort, and that we can see that you probably have something worthwhile. But why did you pick us? I replied that I thought that Castanea was a suitable journal because these experiments were done at Green Bank, West Virginia. And then he ultimately published it. But I found out later that his board of directors chastised him for this. So you see, it's the same old jazz, whether it's the physicists, the astronomers, or the botanists. And who was the Englishman that went to India? Who was the Englishman that went to India and became quite notorious in his discussions about atomic physics and so on? I think he began with H.
Come on, Sri. You were there.
George.
Yeah.
That's all right. Anyhow, he was one of the few people. See, I sent a copy of this to him, and he was one of the few people that thought it was great stuff. And the reason he thought it was great stuff is he was sort of a Bolshevik, too. And he'd like to see anything by anybody that was different. Apparently he was tired of reading the same old stuff.
Well, Grote, I think we should thank you for stimulating 2 days. We admire your curiosity and the breadth of your interests in these pursuits. It's all very fascinating. Good luck. I don't know what the next thing's going to be.
Thank you.
What they mean by you shouldn't fool with Mother Nature. Okay, you got an explanation for that?
No, but this is probably the reason.
Oh, I see.
Mother Nature, she's liable to give you all kinds of screwy answers.
Sure.